The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Lindsay, please call the roll.
Chair Grawl.
Present.
Vice Chair Byrd.
Here.
Republican Whip Gregory.
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll is excused. Representatives Alexander.
Here.
Beltran.
Here.
Brannon. Busada Cabrera.
Here.
Diamond.
Here.
Duggan.
Here.
Fernandez Barquin is excused. Fetterhoff.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Grieco.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Learned.
Here.
Plakin. Roach.
Present.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Trunau.
Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Before we begin, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. Welcome back, members. Today, we will have presentations on the subject of background screening by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and the Department of Education. As far as a roadmap for today's meeting, I expect each presentation to last about 15 to 20 minutes, maybe a little less, depending on the agency, and then we will engage in questions at the conclusion of all of the presentations, okay? And today we welcome Dr. Paul Burns, Deputy Chancellor for Educator Quality at the Department of Education, Taylor Haddock, the Clearinghouse Director for the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and Robin Sparkman, Criminal Justice Information Services Director for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Thank you all very much for being here with us today. We thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to facilitate a deeper understanding of this complicated area of a background screening. And in order to get us started today, Ms. Sparkman, you are recognized to present.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me here today to talk to you about this topic that touches most of us at some point in our lives. Today, I'll just answer some high-level questions of who, what, why, when, where, and how in order to establish a foundation for the discussion that will follow. The who, there are actually two whos. One of those whos are the individuals who are employed, licensed, or volunteer to a position where they will interact with or care for the second who, which is the vulnerable population who are deserving of the protection. The vulnerable populations are usually defined as children, the elderly, or the disabled. The what is the requisite background check, which is the process of state and federal criminal history records repositories. The term background check can take on many meanings and many forms. So the check that I'm speaking of today is specifically the state and national fingerprint-based records checks, whereby responses are provided by recognized criminal history record information repositories. The FBI is designated as the criminal history record repository for federal records, and each state has an agency that is designated as a repository in their respective states. Statute 943 designates FDLE as the criminal history record repository for the state of Florida. Our criminal history record information is maintained in our computerized criminal history system, which we refer to as CCH. There are two flavors of background checks, a level one and a level two. A level one is a name-based, state-only check, and a level two is the state and national fingerprint-based records check. The biometric component of the fingerprint-based records check provides a high confidence level that regardless of the name someone may have legally had or fraudulently used at the time of an arrest, the information of that arrest is tied to their biometrics and not their demographics. The why is that the goal is to afford to Florida's vulnerable populations protection by performing due diligence and screening of individuals who are working with or have custody, care, or control over the vulnerable population. The when is also important. Ideally, background checks and screenings will be performed prior to that person's interaction with the vulnerable population. Further, when an event occurs that could be disqualifying for interaction with that population, it is important that the employing or regulatory entity receive timely notification of that event. And an example of an event like that would be an arrest. This notification is made possible when fingerprints are retained in the fingerprint system after being enrolled during the initial background check process. When fingerprints are retained, they can be matched against other incoming biometric events and generate notifications. Fingerprints that are not retained, in order to screen those individuals again, you have to recreate the screening from the beginning. The where is that the fingerprints are captured at the employing or licensing agency or with a certified live scan vendor. The results are sent to the recipient, the authorized recipient, which is the employing or licensing authority. The employer or licensing authority applies the law or their rules and policy to make a fitness determination. These rules and policies may be documented in law or code, or they may be specific to an industry or left to the discretion of the employer. The how, Florida Statute 943.053 requires FDLE to disseminate criminal justice information only in accordance with federal and state laws, regulations, and rules. State law dictates how state records are used. However, in order to access federal records or records housed in other states' repositories, these checks must be conducted under the provisions of the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact Act, which was ratified by Florida in 943.0543. The compact establishes a legal framework for the sharing of criminal history record information between states for authorized purposes within the rules and standards of use established by the Compact Council. State and national fingerprint-based record checks may be conducted under one of two federal authorities for these vulnerable populations. Either they are authorized by the National Child Protection Act or they are authorized by Public Law 92-544. The National Child Protection Act provides the establishment of a qualified entity. The employer applicant submits fingerprints, which are processed first at the state level and then forwarded to the FBI for processing at the national level. The results of these record checks are returned to the qualified entity who makes a fitness determination. The qualified entity then notifies the applicant of their suitability, and the applicant has the right to challenge a record or the right to have omissions or inaccuracies corrected. Under Public Law 92-544, this is the pathway for access to state and national fingerprint-based records checks when the check is required by state statute. The requirement for the state and national fingerprint-based record check must exist as a result of a legislative enactment and be approved by the United States Attorney General. The legislation must require the check to be fingerprint-based. The employee applicant submits the fingerprint to the state, who then forwards it to the FBI. The legislation must identify specifically the authorization or category for the background check, and a government entity must be the recipient of the results. The rules and standards established by the Compact Council have the intention of both protecting the public from criminal activity and protecting the privacy of the individual submitting to the background check. Requirements that must be considered include: criminal history record information may be obtained only by authorized officials for authorized purposes. The individual who is providing fingerprints must be notified of their rights and how the results of the record check will be used. There are limits on dissemination or sharing of the criminal history record information received as the result of the background check. It may be only shared for the same authorized reason or purpose for which it was acquired. Each time criminal history record identification information is acquired, the process must incorporate positive identification, which is currently defined as biometric identification of 10 rolled or 10 plain flat fingerprints, and the most recent record shall be obtained. The laws that are in place attempt to appropriately balance access to criminal records to those with a need to know and a right to know with the privacy rights of the individual. For example, anything outside of the two stated federal laws would not be authorized to conduct these checks. Publix, for example, could say that they would like to do fingerprint-based state and national fingerprint-based records checks of all their employees. They would not be authorized because they don't fall under the authority of either of the two federal laws. The law simply doesn't provide for it. Many public companies do some variety of a background check. Many are name-based. Some use third-party providers, but the level of scrutiny provided by a state and national fingerprint-based record check is limited to authorized officials for authorized purposes.
Thank you very much for that overview. We appreciate it. Next, we'll hear from Taylor Haddock from the Agency for Healthcare Administration. Welcome, Ms. Haddock.
Good afternoon, Chair Grawl, Vice Chair Byrd, and members of the committee. My name is Taylor Haddock. I'm a Health Administration Services Manager with the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and I'm also the Director of the Care Provider Background Screening Clearinghouse. Before I get started with the presentation, I'm going to take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about myself. I started at the agency in 2004. I became Director of the Clearinghouse in 2013, and I also serve as Chair of the National Forum for Background Checks in partnership with the Association of Healthcare Survey Agencies. So I'm here to talk about the next step in the process of once background checks go to FDLE and then the agencies that review them and the system that our agency and other health and human agencies use. So the Clearinghouse provides a single data source for background screening results of persons required to be screened by law for employment in positions that provide services to children, the elderly, and disabled individuals. The system allows for background screening results to be shared by Health and Human Service agencies when a person has applied to volunteer, be licensed, be employed, or enter a contract that requires a state and national fingerprint-based criminal history check. Brief history on background screening in Florida. In 1998, the Florida legislature established mandatory background screenings for individuals who apply to operate or be employed by a healthcare facility licensed by ACA. Then, in 2001, an interagency work group assembled by ACA published a report on the impact of background screenings and included three recommendations. One, centralized screenings to reduce duplicative screenings among agencies. Two, standardized screening requirements across professions and discipline. Three, create an interagency work group to review and update statutes. This became the base idea for the Clearinghouse. Over the next 9 years, the Florida legislature progressively implemented many of the work group's recommendations, with the most comprehensive changes occurring in 2010, which included standardization of requirements across professions, state and national fingerprinting for all employees and contractors, and authority for participation in a state wrap-back program. While these changes created efficiencies in the process, they also caused unintended consequences of an increase in duplicative screenings and fingerprinting. So how it worked at the time is, if you were a nurse, you had to pay and be fingerprinted to get your license. And then you had to pay and be fingerprinted again to get to be able to be employed at a nursing home. Pay and be fingerprinted again to be a Medicaid provider, and again if you wanted to work at the church daycare on the weekends. The FBI would not allow for a criminal history to be shared for more than one purpose. In 2011, the legislature developed a new interagency background screening work group with a primary goal of reducing those duplicative screenings. FDLE was a part of that work group and was able to work with the FBI to allow for the sharing of screenings as long as they met certain conditions. So in 2012, the Clearinghouse was passed by the legislature. The Clearinghouse system was able to be built with the assistance of a federal grant from the National Background Check Program, and Florida was one of the first of six states awarded that grant. There are a total of seven state agencies that participate in the Clearinghouse. ACA and DOH were the first to join in 2013, and all agencies were implemented by August of 2016. All the specified agencies have worked really well together to implement the system and educate their providers, and all the agencies participate in a Clearinghouse Agency Advisory Board where we are in constant communication about system updates or issues. The clearinghouse has two components, an internal system for processing screenings by state employees and an external system for providers and licensees to initiate screenings and maintain employee rosters. Some of the benefits of the clearinghouse are the sharing of the criminal history checks. So now that nurse that I mentioned previously will go and be licensed and have that screening. And then that same screening can then be shared for multiple reasons for free. Also, there's arrest hit notifications for employees listed on an employee roster. There's tracking of screenings from initiation to eligibility determination with email updates to the provider along the way, and a connection to the LiveScan service provider. So demographic information only has to be entered once and hopefully correctly, and then it can be sent to the LiveScan when an appointment is made. The clearinghouse also provides a Florida public rap sheet for the initiating provider. This allows for the provider to see offenses that are not disqualifying but may need to be taken into consideration for the position type. For example, DUI is not disqualifying, but the provider may choose to take that into consideration if the job that they're hiring for is a driver for the facility. The clearinghouse also has an employee roster for maintaining hire and separation dates for each employee. This allows the clearinghouse to know where to send notifications of eligibility changes, such as an arrest of an employee. The clearinghouse also allows providers to request and pay for the renewal of fingerprints in the system. This is a cost savings to the provider employee because they don't have to pay for that extra screening fee at the LiveScan. There's also a faster processing time because you don't have to wait for the appointment at the LiveScan, get fingerprinted, have it sent, and all that. And then it also provides an updated criminal history and extends the retention of fingerprints for another 5 years. The clearinghouse has processed over 5.5 million screenings since 2013, and with the sharing of those screenings, has saved healthcare providers and licensees nearly $92 million. While the savings are very beneficial, the most important impact of the clearinghouse is the improved safety and care of our vulnerable population. Previously, a state agency may not have learned about an arrest of an employee until their next required screening, which could have been as many as 5 years away. To date, over 250,000 arrests have been reported to the clearinghouse, and over 25% of those arrested were no longer eligible to work with vulnerable citizens. Now, all agencies participating in the clearinghouse receive instant notification of the arrest, ensuring that only qualified individuals provide care for vulnerable Floridians. Beyond the number of screenings we have processed and arrests we have worked, the clearinghouse also won the 2016 Digital Government to Business National Award by the National Association of Chief Information Officers. Additionally, since inception, the clearinghouse return on investment is over 700%. Now, with the clearinghouse nearing 10 years old, the system is becoming antiquated. The system started as AHCA's original background screening system and wasn't originally built to handle over 5 million screenings. The agency is currently working on a modernization of the system that is expected to be implemented in 2022. The modernization will include streamlined screening processes for both providers and state employees, advanced reporting capabilities, improved user experience, including better guidance and assistance in the clearinghouse results website, and an easily scalable foundation to allow for easy growth of the clearinghouse, such as other agencies wanting to join. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Haddock. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Paul Burns with the Department of Education. Welcome, Mr. Burns. Dr. Burns.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member. My name is Paul Burns. I'm Deputy Chancellor for Educator Quality at the Florida Department of Education, and it's my pleasure to be here with you today to talk about this very important topic of background screenings, which help to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of all of Florida students. Florida statute requires all employees to undergo background screenings as a condition of employment and as a condition of continued employment. The background screenings include, but are not limited to, employment history checks and statewide criminal correspondence checks through the Department of Law Enforcement and the FBI, and a check for the National Sex Offender Public website, and they may include local criminal records checks through our local law enforcement agencies. Fingerprints remain on file with FDLE and are subject to renewal every 5 years. So when we look at who is screened, Florida Statute 101232 does require all instructional and non-instructional personnel who are hired or contracted to fill positions that require direct contact with students to be screened upon employment or to be screened once they have an engagement to provide services. These individuals must undergo background screenings as required under 1012-465, and that's the statute for certain non-instructional school district employees and contractors, or the individuals have to be screened under 1012-56, which is the statute that outlines the requirements for educator certification. So when we look at how those results are utilized, both the employing entity and the Department of Education receive the results of the background screening for their intended purposes only. So at the department, we review the results of background screening to determine an individual's eligibility to hold a Florida educator certificate. And those records cannot be shared outside of the department and may not be used for other purposes. On the other hand, employing entities also receive the results of the background screening, and they use those results to determine the individual's eligibility for employment. So the example we give, for example, is you might have a teacher who is seeking employment. Those fingerprint screening results would go not only to us at the department for certification and licensure purposes, it'd also be sent to the employing entity. Another example we use, for example, is someone who's not serving in a position that requires an educator certificate. The results of those background screenings would only go to the employing entity. So on this slide, you will see the entire really process from beginning to end. So I'll call your attention to that top box there where it says the employer must have the potential employees screened before they're officially hired. So that's really the start of that process. And if you follow that little wheel around, when an individual is seeking employment in a school district, they are required to undergo the background screening by completing the fingerprint process. Again, the results of the background screening from both FDLE and the FBI are received by the employing entity and potentially the department based on the position for which the individual is applying. Based on the results of that background screening, the individual is either deemed eligible or ineligible for employment, and if they're applying for educator certification, they are again deemed eligible or ineligible for certification. And as I shared earlier, those fingerprints do remain on file with FDLE and are subject to renewal every 5 years. Background screenings are required for both initially and periodically for individuals either seeking or holding a Florida educator certificate. As I just shared on the previous slide, school districts or employing entities collect the fingerprints, and then individuals are subject to that entire screening process that you just saw on the last slide. House Bill 131, which was passed after last legislative session and signed into law, also recently created the disqualification list, which now will be updated following those screening results. So under this new legislation, individuals whose results of a background screening reflect a disqualifying offense under 1012.315 will be now subject to placement on the disqualification list and will be barred from employment at public schools and private schools that accept scholarships and programs for K-12 students. For employing entities, again, they're responsible for receiving and obtaining those fingerprints and reviewing the results of the background screening. And then school districts also pay FDLE annually for the records to be retained. There are just a few exceptions that you see there on the screen in front of you that really outline the very rare exceptions of individuals that may not undergo a background screening if there's access to students, but those individuals would have potentially been screened then through their other agencies. And so with that, Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. And if we can have maybe all of the speakers come up to the front panel, that would be helpful. Members, this is an issue that came onto my radar, I would say, probably my first year serving, when you just start to hear about the difference in background checks that are used in different entities and whether or not it's with childcare or school teachers. You might have school teachers that work in an after-school program on that campus, but they would get screened through FDLE for their as a school teacher and for their certification, but because they were involved with an after-school program, that would be considered childcare, so they'd also have to get screened through ACCA because that's considered childcare. Then further, you know, as a parent and having children who are involved in different activities, you know, I may be screened three times a year in order to participate in those different activities, and that screening is not portable. And so what we see with the ACCA Clearinghouse is that there is some portability for individuals who have been screened, they are in the system, and they can point to different entities. They can get, the individual can give permission and point to different entities to have access to that information, so they don't have to go through that additional cost as we heard about. And so really, I would like us to, you know, have a conversation about, you know, how we could make the entire system more coordinated to be more user-friendly to the individuals who want to participate in either more activities, want to have different jobs, that they don't have to incur the cost when they go from job to job of having that background screening done more regularly than necessary. And I want to thank the three agencies that are here and participating. We've had many hours of conversations in preparation for this meeting, and they've really engaged in a kind of problem-solving, solution-finding, conversation around these issues. And I think that it's important that we do everything we can to make sure that we are protecting our vulnerable populations. And the more consistent we are with the policy associated with these background screenings, I believe that that would increase the vulnerability of those populations, because we have a better handle on the policy, the disqualifying factors, the way they're applied, and employers and qualified entities are better able to understand how to appropriately screen and monitor their employees or volunteers. So that's kind of just the foundation for what and the impetus for the conversation today. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions. Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for the presentation. I'd like to ask a question about the Department of Education. And in my report, I had something that said certain private schools would be required. Can you speak to what type of a private school that might be?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the private schools that accept scholarships through the Department of Education, through that program.
Representative Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for this conversation, something I've been looking forward to have. I've got a series of questions that I'll run through you for Dr. Burns. Good to see you again, and also everyone on the panel. I guess starting with the live scan, that initial collection, you know, that is authorized through DOE, how come some districts allow, you know, the user to go to any authorized live scan location in the state, but then there are others who require that actually happens at a live scan facility on site at the district, which can become very laborious and just the time build up there. Is there any rationale, or is that just something that's left to the districts?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So I will have to get back with you and look at that. When when individuals apply for educator certification, we actually mail them a document with their statement of status of eligibility, informing them of whether they're eligible or ineligible for a certificate. We actually provide information for them on where they can conduct their fingerprints through a live scan provider. But for particular districts and if they're sending them to different scanners or not, I'd have to look into that and get back with you, Representative.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And just for the record, I can tell you that for the examples that I'm thinking of off the top of my head, it's more geared towards that employment verification, and that there 100% are multiple districts in the state that require that to come on site, which just creates a significant backlog of individuals who are able to get cleared. An additional question, when you talked about the employing entities and who those background, or those screening results are shared with for employment, what is the definition of an employing entity?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Those would be, for example, our school districts or a charter school or a school of hope. So that's what we mean by an employing entity, because it could be a charter school or traditional public school or school of hope.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a gotcha question, but again, just to perhaps bring to your attention, I could tell you certainly from a number of the different charter schools that I've spoken with, they have an extremely difficult time, and in fact, part of my next question kind of leads into that. With clearances that you know, the results come from FDLE, they come down to the district. Are you aware of specific examples of, let's say, there is a criminal activity that pops on that screening? It's not on the disqualified list, but for some reason, a district is still saying ineligible for employment, you know, waiting on disposition of a case, or again, something that's not even on that eligible list. Is that something that you guys are hearing about?
You recognize.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Representative, for that question. So when an individual then is fingerprinted and the employing entity receives those results, the districts or the employing entity is then making a determination of if they feel like that candidate is eligible for employment or not. That does vary from district to district. So there are some districts, for example, that may say they don't want, someone that has had a felony within 5 years, or another district may say that it's in 10 years. So districts are making decisions on the employability of that individual if they don't have a disqualifying offense.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Burns, for that. I think this is something I definitely want to sidebar with you on, because, and this is probably half question, half statement, going back to the previous question on who is an employing entity, I know of multiple examples of, let's just use the example of a charter school or a school of hope, who is forced by district protocol to have the fingerprints happen at the district level. Then the district receives the results but will not actually share those results with the true hiring entity. They keep it bottlenecked at the district. And then the district is putting arbitrary rules saying we need either dispositions of cases or, you know, again, they might not even share what the incident was, but it's precluding those actual employing entities from seeing that and being able to make the determination in accordance with statute. So just curious if you could speak to that a little bit.
Recognize, Dr.
Thank you, Chair. So districts and charter schools have an agreement when they about that process, and so I will have to look into that if there are specific instances of where districts would not be sharing that with a charter school, but those are certainly things that I could get back to the Chair through and look at some of those particular instances.
You're recognized for additional questions.
Last question, I promise. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a question for both Dr. Burns and then also for FDLE, do you envision or could you see a pathway where charter schools would be able to contract directly with FDLE, submit those live scan results to FDLE, receive them directly, and bypass the district altogether?
You're recognized.
So that's something, again, I think that we would have to look into. I don't know if the colleague here from FDLE wants to add information from that, but that's something I think that we would have to look into, but that's a very good question.
Ms. Sparkman, can you speak maybe to how schools that don't fall under the purview necessarily of DOE would interact with FDLE? That might.
Yes, thank you. The option of becoming a live scan provider, I believe, would be open to anyone who's willing to go through the certification process. The complexities of receiving the background check, actually screening for the screening criteria, would be on the schools to figure out. FDLE would not be involved in that portion of it.
Representative Learned, you're recognized for question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this topic. As a small business owner, I've paid for a lot of these background checks over the years, but I never really understood the process at all, so I think there's probably a lot of people watching that are learning a lot right now. My question, I'm going to step back a little bit from the previous line. What is the process for removing somebody from the system? Let's say we heard testimony, I don't know if it was in this committee or a different one in the judiciary, but about the law enforcement reporting requirements. So like crimes are reported, but they're not necessarily removed from the system if those people are acquitted of those crimes. So what is the process to remove somebody's infraction, like after a jury has heard the case?
Ms. Sparkman, you're recognized.
Thank you. The background check that you receive as the result of a fingerprint submission is a snapshot in time. It was received dependent upon the information in the criminal history repository of that individual at the point in time that the fingerprints were processed. If subsequent changes occur to that criminal record to include the addition of new criminal information, or let's say they got expunged, they had an expungement or a record sealed, or an updated disposition that changed them from adjudication withheld and not guilty or dropped, anything along that line, that would not appear in that snapshot simply because it wasn't there at the time that the fingerprint was submitted and processed. So subsequent checks would reveal changes in that criminal record. For the retention, when those fingerprints are retained in the system, when new information comes in, it does trigger a notification that new information is there. But if information is removed or modified, there is currently no trigger event in the state of Florida for that.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow up on that, I guess. So if, where are the gaps that exist in the system then? Like, are there people that are doing things or getting acquitted from things that are not getting caught in this system?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Each time that an individual is fingerprinted, voluntarily submits their fingerprints for the purpose of a background check, they are issued a privacy notification. And in that privacy notification, they're basically sort of waiving a little bit of their privacy in order for this record to be divulged to the person who has the need to know or the right to know. And in that privacy notification, it also tells them what they can do to correct any deficiencies, inaccuracies, or if they believe they need to challenge the entirety of the record, that it isn't them or any part of it. So there is a process, a due process, for the challenge of the correction of a record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an unrelated second question. I was an economics major in college, and I wanted to ask, because I always do these when I hire new people, right? So to me, this would be an indication of the health of our economy, how many jobs we've created. Have you seen growth? We've heard that this year was a record growth in the number of jobs across Florida. Are you seeing record numbers of new people getting background checks because of that?
You're recognized.
I think our rate, hold on a second, is pretty consistent. They've declined a little bit since COVID, I'm being told, but fairly consistent over the years. It ramped up as legislation has been passed requiring additional background checks, and it's kind of leveled off with the dip for COVID.
Representative Roach, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, panel members. My question is, can a district deny the employment of a charter school or private school employee based on the background screening, even if it's a non-disqualifying crime?
You're recognized.
So the employing entity does set their own regulations and policies around the eligibility of employment for an individual. So if an individual is fingerprinted at an employing entity like a school or district, and they have an arrest notification that is not a disqualifying offense, each individual employing entity sets their own guardrails around whether that person is eligible or ineligible for employment.
Thank you.
Can you speak a little bit to portability outside of the AGCA Clearinghouse, Ms. Sparkman, and maybe some of the challenges around positive identification that we've had conversations about, and you know, if you have suggested policy solutions for how we may make the system, you know, more portable, make background screenings more portable for individuals.
Yes, the very individuals that we're trying to protect our vulnerable populations from are typically the individuals that know how to work around the system. So to detect that kind of, or to prevent that kind of fraudulent activity, one of the components of the background check process is that we have positive biometric identification of that individual at each background check. So that way, someone who looks very similar to me, say my younger sister or my first cousin, can't say, look at my photo, this is me with a photo ID. I've already passed a background check. You can employ me here. So currently, federal authorities define positive identification as a full rolled set of 10 print or a flat impression of all 10 prints of a finger of both hands. So biometric technology has evolved since that definition was created, and we hope to be able to go back to the FBI and have discussions with the Compact Council about updating that that definition to accept new biometric modalities such as iris scans or perhaps a less than 10 ident to an existing 10 print. So we hope to be able to open those doors for conversations going forward.
Ms. Haddock, can you discuss how AGCA handles positive identification with regard to portability, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So we do the photograph to be retained or in the clearinghouse. The requirements from the FBI to be able to share was a photograph has to be taken at the time of fingerprinting. So when they go to the live scan, a photograph is taken there, and that is actually sent to the clearinghouse for our system. Additionally, we require a social security number or the ITIN of the individual to be a part of the clearinghouse, and then obviously name, date of birth, other demographic information. So when an employer goes in to search somebody, if they want to hire them, they have to have the social and either last name or date of birth to actually even look somebody up in the system. You can't just go in and see a bunch of pictures and background screens of people. You have to have information to be able to see them, to see that. And then from there, we do have a photo display with the idea that this person that sat in front of you at an interview is the same that has the picture in the system.
Thank you. Do you believe that the AGCA Clearinghouse has the ability to be built out to handle more agencies with policy changes?
I do, not the current system, but with our new build, the goal is to make it more scalable to be able to add other agencies if they are interested. Obviously, it would take more than just our system to do that.
And can I hear, maybe it's this is for Ms. Sparkman, I'm not sure about the National Rat Back Program. Am I saying that correct? So with regard to that program, can you speak to the members about what additional information that would give us for those individuals that have been background screened or their employers? And what is the process? I heard that we agreed to participate many years ago, that we would participate in the program. So at what stage are we right now in that participation, and what is the long-term plan for being fully operable with the National Rat Back Program?
Yes, Chair, thank you. The current level of wrap back participation is statewide for anyone whose statute permits it or who has subsequently enrolled or asked to be incorporated into statewide wrap back. That means that if anyone who has whose fingerprints are being retained gets arrested in the state of Florida and we process those fingerprints in our biometric identification solution, the match will occur and a arrest hit notification will go out. The premise is the same for the national wrap-back system, meaning that now what happens in Vegas does not stay in Vegas. If that person drives 20 minutes north across the state line and commits a crime in Georgia, that you would get notification, the same or similar notification that you would get for statewide wrap-back. In addition, if that person's we call it an FBI number, they now call it a UCN for a uniform control number, were used to enter a warrant, enroll that individual on the National Sex Offender Registry, those activities would also trigger a national notification back to the qualified entity or the licensing or regulatory authority. Right now, we are enrolling our criminal justice partners. We've identified those jurisdictions that closely align with the state line to try to get them enrolled into the national wrap back system. The proof of concept is working very well. We haven't had too many hiccups along the way. For law enforcement, criminal justice, it's a no-cost situation. So it's low-hanging fruit. We're able to get them in very easily. For participation by entities other than criminal justice, there will be some cleanup of their existing lists of retained applicants that'll need to be done first. There will be a cost associated with reinitiating the entire background check on that person in order to accomplish enrollment. There will be a workload in that initiation of that background check will also bring back a record that will have to be screened and vetted again by human resources or whoever does that screening, and then that individual will be enrolled into the national wrap-back system. So there are a few hurdles to overcome. One, of course, is that your legislation has to permit participation in the national system as well.
I'm the only one with questions today. So my next question is about summer camps and maybe youth coaches. And if you could help me understand how, it's my understanding that anyone that works with children would have to have a level 2 background check pursuant to statute, but how would a parent be able to know that summer camp or you know, winter camp, spring break camp, whatever it is, or youth coach program has participated and made sure all their volunteers or employees have participated in the background check process?
Thank you. I don't know how a parent would validate that or verify that without asking to ensure, and if the oversight of that association is through a regulatory authority, then that regulatory authority would be able to say that it had been done by that association.
So if there is no regulatory authority for summer camps, the parent would just have to take the camp at their word that they have performed the background checks? Would that be accurate?
I am not familiar with whether or not these camps associated with, if they're associated with the school or how they're associated, would fall under the purview of DCF as a child care provider. If they fall under the purview of child care provider, then DCF would be the regulatory authority.
Okay. It's my understanding that they don't license them, and so that's why it's just an area that I've tried to figure out. Are there any other questions, members? Seeing none, I want to thank you all for being here today and for participating in this important conversation, and I look forward to continued conversations about how we can streamline the system and hopefully, you know, ensure for safer, vulnerable population in Florida and how we can help with engagement in the National Wrap Back Program and those conversations about, you know, any legislative activity that may need to happen in order to make sure that this is a good process without holes and without areas that we're missing. So thank you very much to all of you. Members, thank you for your participation in the conversation today. And having no further business before the committee, this concludes our agenda. And Representative Gregory moves we rise. And without objection, the meeting is adjourned.